darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence in restless dreams.
Charlie.
So shall we talk about love?
We can talk about love for about 20 minutes because I've got a date with my girlfriend to watch the second series, the second season of 6 Feet Under.
More love. Love is 6 Feet Under and love is hugging the girlfriend.
we just rented episodes 1 to 7 from the second season. So yeah, it's a wonderful series. It's a wonderful show, 6 Feet Under.
What universe is this now? Is this
one
a universe?
I've lost track of all the universes, Charlie. There's too many of them.
Yes.
Yeah, I loved your all those photos. Amazing.
Yeah, that I mean, it's so interesting to look back on that now, and see it as, did any of that actually happen? Well, yes and no.
Yeah. Both, isn't it?
Both, yeah.
Both, yeah.
The book is, although the self is certainly not in any book, and the love is not in any book, there is a certain fragrance or a poetry about it. I remember a friend saying that, you know, a poet is someone who feels, I'll paraphrase it, a poet is someone who feels life fully and completely and raw and open and expresses that with words. And those words can evoke a similar seeing, knowing, experiencing for the reader who reads with an open heart and an open ear, so to speak. So that's my experience of your book, you know, talking English as though there's a me. My experience of your book is it is sublime poetry in the kind of in the genre of a Rumi or a Hafiz or even Muktananda, who wrote some poetry, and others of that ilk. So, you know, I'm not placing you on a pedestal. And at the same time, as far as I'm concerned, your expression is identical to theirs in the formlessness and love of it, if not in the exact content. And so that, I think your book is, in as much as anything, is important. I think it's going to be a very important one over time. And so the first thing the first thing I want to do is thank you for, you know, opening yourself so completely and fully and sharing without, obviously, you have no fear of any consequences, because if you did, it would be happening, because if there is no one, then who's afraid?
Yeah. Charlie, I mean, thank you so much. It's really, really sweet of you. And yeah, I don't know what to say, really. Maybe I should say nothing.
Isn't that what you've been saying all along?
It's true. Why break the habit of a lifetime? Maybe we'll just do a silent podcast, I think, from now on.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. But it is, of course, you know, as the song goes, the sounds of silence. It's the silence whispering these sweet nothings into the ear of the forlorn seeker and lifting him out of his or her mire. So one commenter on the podcast number 15, which is the one that you and I did the other day, part of it, is, you know, I wish Jeff would talk about relationships. And, you know, of course, lo and behold, there in the book, you do talk about relationships. Mm. And relationship seems to be another one of those non-duality taboos like love.
Yeah, because there's no one here to have a relationship, right? You know,
yeah, what nonsense!
That's the way. That's how we get out. That's how we avoid talking about relationships. We just dismiss the whole thing by saying, "Well, no one here, no relation." Which again, is true, you know, in an absolute sense. But I think as I said in the last podcast, we don't live in the absolute. You know, we don't live in the ultimate. You know, so although in an ultimate sense, of course, there's no one here, there's no one talking, there's no one listening, there's no one seeing, there's no one breathing, there's no one here to be in a relationship with anyone else, and yet, there appears to be this astonishing play of, you know, human relationships of time and space, and it might all be a dream, and it might all be essentially unreal, but it, as we were saying in the last podcast, who could deny the appearance of everything? If there's really no one here, then there's really no one here who could deny anything, you know? And so where does that leave you? That leaves you, you know, sitting in a cafe, sitting in Starbucks, having a coffee with your girlfriend or with a friend or with, I don't know, mother, father, sister, brother, you know, and again, ultimately no one there, no one meeting no one. But, you know, obviously within the dream, within the world, you know, and again, I know that's a taboo to use that word, you know. Within reality, you know, there's a person there drinking coffee with another person, and let's honor that, you know, let's begin there, let's yeah. begin there and see sure. what happens, you know, and let's not get into this denial stuff, because
well,
it gets,
you know,
so...
there was a wonderful German philosopher I think you're familiar with, named Martin Heidegger, and Heidegger discussed the being in the world. And when he talked about being in the world, what I took from that is that he wasn't talking about two separate things. It was all one, being in the world. And it didn't deny the world as so many other philosophies had done. It actually embraced the duality as the perfect expression of the non-dual. And I think that's what you're pointing at with what you're saying in writing, and you know, I think if that message is missed, because the mind wants to understand or grasp or own something for itself, then, you know, love remains very far away. But not an actual fact, of course.
No,
because even that is love.
Well, exactly. You can't escape it, can you? But just with this book, I just really wanted to strip away all the bullshit, even all the, you know, non-duality Advaita bullshit, and get right back to the aliveness of everything, you know, just life happening, and you know, to honor the message of radical Advaita, radical non-duality, to honor that message, but also then to, from that perspective almost, to come back into the world. You know, to come back into the world, you know, and again, it's like the world is illusory. Brahman alone is real. And then the third bit is Brahman is the world. It is the world. And that feels much more real to me these days, you know, rather
reminds
than
me of something that the Buddha is purported to have said, is that samsara is dukkha. The world is suffering, or the appearance is suffering. Samsara is dukkha. Nirvana is shanti, in other words, extinction of the me is peace. But then he added a third line, which you rarely hear. And these are not two.
These are not two. And that's what the word non-duality is really pointing to. It's not pointing to a philosophy for the individual to take on the philosophy of I'm not here, you're not there, nothing exists, no time, no space, no this, no that. That's, and again, there's an ultimate truth to that. But as we were saying in the last podcast, you know, the moment the individual believes that, it becomes a religion, and then the infighting begins. You know, I'm right, you're wrong. I'm not here, you're still there. I don't have an ego, you still have an ego. I see this, you don't see this yet. I mean, it just descends into just a battle of egos.
Well, it's really. Like a cat fight, you know. It's amazing.
I just wanted to get away from all of that. I just wanted to get away from that. Because I think that's what gives non-duality a bad name.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I can understand why for a lot of people the word non-duality has become a dirty word. I can really understand that.
Sure.
I can really understand that. I mean, it's become starting to become perhaps, I don't know, associated with this kind of just catty infighting, this kind of bitchy infighting, you know.
I think it's something really unseen that drives that. It's like a human paradigm of right, wrong, good, bad. This is right, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like the way it's seen here is that I don't think, or you don't think, or we don't think those thoughts. We think from that assumption. Mm-hmm. We think from the assumption of separation into the appearance of the world. And when we do that, we cannot love because we're in opposition all the time. Mm. And that's war. Mm. And I mean, it's so stunningly strange here now that we are at war with ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're fighting ourself. Mm. The other is myself. So, you know, I think the ultimate relationship is the seeing that I and other are both two and one.
Yeah. It's both. It's both. And it's neither and it's both. And at some point you just have to admit that, you know, you cannot understand this. If you think you get this, if you think you understand this.
Beep.
Well, that's a dead understanding. That's what that is. That's memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a memory. It's become the memory of non-duality, and you've already moved away from the livingness of it, the aliveness of it. Okay, that was non-duality a moment ago. What does that word mean now? You know, that word really is, it's a living word, non-duality, and it's like, what does it mean? I don't know. I don't know now. I don't know now. The moment you think you know what it means, you've moved into a religion. You've become a religious person. And then, you start to deny that you're a person. You know,
that's another religion.
That's another religion. So, like, let's just strip away all the bullshit and get back to what this is really about, you know, which is life as it is, life as it appears, as it appears presently, you know, and non-duality cannot be captured by any concept or set of concepts, you know, and let's always begin again. Let's never know what this means, you know. Let's be totally ignorant about what non-duality really is.
Reminds me of something Esther Gedada said about that: when I know I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I know I am everything, that's love. And this life moves between those two.
Yeah, and that's why I chose that quote to go at the front of my book, because I think
is it
that,
in there? I didn't know.
Oh, it's in the new version. It's in the version that was published.
Oh,
I think the version you have is slightly old.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm glad to hear it.
I thought, well, that says it all.
Yeah.
that says it all, and
now of course the mind will turn that into a new religion.
Of course. And you know, that's really all the poor little mind can do. So it's like,
well, you talk about innocence, and you know, I think that innocence is something that is rarely really understood here in the way you point to it. And that might be also useful to have here.
Mm.
A little discussion of innocence.
Innocence. I guess just seeing that, so let's start from the beginning, really. And I know I've only got about 10 minutes before we have to watch 6 Feet Under, but that's
okay.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I might only have 10 minutes before I am 6 feet under. After all, I'm 72. My friend John Grubin sometimes sends me an email saying, well, okay, you still above ground? Haven't heard from you. You still above ground?
So, one thing we can say for sure is within 10 minutes, one of us will be 6 feet under. okay, so I forgot what we were talking about.
The beginning?
Beginning. So, I mean...
In the beginning was the word.
And the word was, I don't know what the word was, but so look, this whole thing really, it's rooted in a rejection of what is. I mean, look, if that's where the seeking begins, isn't it? Is with this isn't enough on some level, like this isn't enough. What's happening presently, it's not enough. It's not enough. Like if this was enough, if what was happening was always enough. If there was just contentment with this as it appears, the seeking would never begin. You know, the seeking is always rooted in a just a rejection, you know, in basically in separation, rejection, same thing really.
Yeah.
And so on some level, you know, the seeking always made life into the enemy, you know, life as it is was never enough, you know. So just sitting on this chair, you know, with a mug of tea and clothes on my body and a carpet and windows, this was never enough. And you know, the search, my search, you know, everyone's search, you know, whether it's the spiritual search or the material search, I mean, it's the same seeking essentially. It's always rooted in that sense of lack, you know. So what happens is life ends up becoming the enemy. In other words, you know, especially when we get hooked on into these spiritual concepts, you know, this idea of awakening or enlightenment, you know, it's like this present appearance, this room, say the chair, the table, the carpet, the ceiling. Just the absolute simplicity and obviousness of what appears presently.
It's interesting. We moved from mundane sort of seeking, a kind of mundane materialism to spiritual materialism, isn't it?
I mean, it's the same movement, though, isn't it? It's the same.
Yeah, we seek to be spiritual people, and better
it's
people.
And it's all for me, you know, yeah. The root of the whole thing. It's whether it's worldly success or spiritual success, you know.
All self-centered.
The ultimate spiritual success is enlightenment. You know, yeah. We hold that up, that's the ultimate goal. And in our myth, in our mythology, in our religion, you know, only a few very special people have ever become enlightened. That's the myth. So that,
well,
that
I'm so happy that you're one of them.
Oh, God. That's, I mean, it's a wonderful
myth,
you know, and it's a beautiful story. I mean, it's a lovely dream. It's a lovely dream. But
we just go on trying to make our dream a better dream, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's like we're sitting here in this room, you know, with the chair, the table, the mug of tea, the breathing. It's like this grace, you know, like everything is given here in this moment, everything. You know, and it might not necessarily be what the individual wants, but it was never about what the individual wants. You know, without those stories, this is just grace. It's just, it's what it is. It's not even grace. There's no name for it. You know, it's what it is. But, so then we get hooked on this idea of enlightenment, you know, so it's like, one day I'm going to awaken from this, you know, one day I'm going to be enlightened from the world. It's like awakening from, it's always from, you know, it's like, it's always freedom from. That's what we're looking for. That's all the individual could possibly look for, is freedom from. So it's always a movement away from what's happening. We're looking for freedom from pain, freedom from suffering, freedom from life, you know, freedom from the world. And that's, and then we, so we see enlightenment, enlightenment in our mythology is the ultimate freedom from. And so it's like, again, on some level, we've made what we call the ordinary, because of course there is no ordinary, but what we call the ordinary, you know, the chair, the table, the mug of coffee, the mug of tea, noises, you know, from outside, cars beeping their horns, you know, the air conditioning fan. It's like one day we're going to awaken from this. Like this isn't good enough. So on some level, it's almost like we see the world as some sort of block. Like the chair, the table, the air conditioner, the mug of tea. Somehow, all of that worldly stuff, all of that, those objects, those nasty little objects, those unreal, illusory things that don't really exist. Somehow, they're getting in the way of our awakening. They're getting in the way of our enlightenment. Because surely, enlightenment, as we see it, it's the ultimate transcendence of the chair, the table, you know, phenomena. You know, it's kind of, we're waiting to transcend all of this. So it's like we've made all of this into the enemy because it's getting in the way. Like the life, you know, the ordinary stuff of life, sensations happening, feelings, thoughts, objects, other people, you know, that's all getting in the way of me being no one. Because everything around is kind of reminding me that I'm someone, you know. So it's all, in a way, it's all nasty. It's all illusory somehow. I mean, and that's,
well, I think it must be a huge right wing conspiracy.
Maybe. So we always made this into the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was always the seeking.
It's always battling what is, isn't it?
What is. The seeking made this into the enemy. So it's like coming to see how innocent everything was. That we made it into the enemy in our quest to be someone, in our search for something, in our pursuit of our goals. It was all about us. It was all about me, in our narcissism. Really, I mean, that's what it comes in, our narcissism. Look what we did to the world. Look what we did. We destroyed all of this. This was nothing anymore. This became meaningless because we wanted something higher. You know, and that's what most people think of. Mm. You know, when they use the word spirituality, it's something higher, something more meaningful than a chair, more meaningful than breathing, more meaningful than a cup of coffee. And of course, it was always that. You know, that search for meaning that made this meaningless. It's like we no longer, it's like the cup of coffee wasn't enough. The breathing, something as simple as breathing in and out, that wasn't enough. The carpet on the floor wasn't enough. The piece of toast wasn't enough. We wanted awakening. We wanted enlightenment. And all the time, how innocent everything was, you know, how innocent it all was, and seeing just when all of that nonsense falls away, you know, all of that narcissistic nonsense falls away, how innocent everything is. You know, it was never the enemy. How could there be an enemy? An enemy implies two.
Mm. Yeah, only when you see other. Do you see a me, and vice versa, isn't it? And so then it's fight or flight. It's you know, embrace or avoid. But never just seeing the beauty and the simplicity of it, isn't it?
And it's, you know, in something as simple as a chair, say, you know, it's like the moment we call it a chair already. Bam, we're into chair and me, you know. Subject, object, chair and the one who sees the chair. Right. I see the chair. me separate from chairs. So it's then like, oh, and this starts, you know, as very, very young children. We start to name everything and learn all the names, and we start to know everything. And before you know it, we know everything. Oh, I know it's a chair. It's just a chair. It's just a mug of coffee. It's just a carpet. It's just life happening. Boy, we could become so bored with them. We're so bored with just what's happening. And that's, of course, when we start to latch on to these spiritual concepts. Ah, awakening from this. Now that sounds like fun, because this is nothing.
Yeah.
So it's already rooted in a rejection of this. So no wonder it can only ever lead to more rejection.
And that's definitely the opposite of innocence.
Exactly. Exactly. But seen in clarity, it's just the innocence of it is stunning.
Mm.
I mean, it's just...
The innocence of the little baby's eyes.
Yeah. Or the... I mean, just everything. Just everything.
The incredible honesty of space.
Mm. And the way everything is... Like it's already given. You know, everything is, it's just given. This is all given for free. It doesn't care if you're awakened or not, enlightened or not, in your own story. It doesn't care how old you are, or what color you are, what religion you are. It doesn't care what you believe, what you don't believe, or what color hair you have, what you look like, or what you've done. I mean, that's forgiveness. You know, this, we always thought forgiveness was something that we had to do. It's like, this is already forgiven. You know, everything is forgiven. It's like the crucifixion has already happened.
It's an incredible word, forgiveness. You know, looking at it a little more deeply, I see that the root of forgiveness is giving.
Mm.
The gift.
Mm-hmm.
The gift of this. And this never asks anything of us.
No.
Man, and that's all, love, you know. That's real, yeah, that's unconditional love. I mean, those vertical blinds across the room are just giving themselves with love.
It's just unconditional love dressed up as everything. Mm. So it's like, no wonder we couldn't find unconditional love. We couldn't find it in some imaginary future, because it was already... showing itself, you know, offering itself, revealing itself. It's always been revealing itself. It's just we couldn't see it because we were so lost in this seeking game, which is ultimately the narcissistic game. It's the me game. Looking for something, looking for something. And of course, it's like we were looking for something. Actually, what we longed for more than anything was everything. But we were always looking for some things. And no wonder we couldn't find oneness, whatever you want to call it. No wonder we couldn't find life.
I mean, it's really strange, isn't it, Jeff, that you know, that we're seeking our absence.
Mm.
Yeah, seeking our absence. Because Emperor said in the movie Amadeus, there it is. Here it is.
Yeah.
Here it is.
It's been here all along. That's the...
Staring us in the face.
Really, literally.
Literally, those blinds, that painting, this table, this bottle of green tea in the hand, staring, God staring me in the face. Saying, and when are you going to notice me?
Yeah, but the shocking thing, and the thing that is so utterly shocking and shattering for the seeker is how ordinary it appears.
Yeah.
That's the And for a seeker, that can be a massive disappointment. You know, with a seeker, with all their fancy concepts and ideas they've picked up about what this is supposed to look like.
Well, it's really the death of hope, isn't it?
The death of hope. But it's also the death of hopelessness.
Yes, they go together, don't they?
They go together. It's the people say, sometimes people listen to this message and they say, well, it's, Jeff, it's hopeless. This is a hopeless message. Well, it's not even that, because, you know, you only say this is hopeless if you're still clinging on to hope.
Yeah.
If you still want hope, if you're still looking for hope. But when hope is no longer there, there cannot be any hopelessness. There's no hopelessness here.
Of course.
This isn't even a hopeless message.
There's neither hope nor hopelessness in this.
Exactly. Or people say, you know, this, it's like you're saying everything's meaningless. Well, it's not even that, because...
No, that's to add meaning to something that is inherently empty.
Mm. Well, it's shockingly meaningless and shockingly meaningful. I mean, it's like neither and both. And at that point, like, it is what it is. You know, you call it meaningful or you call it meaningless. But beyond both, you know, what is there? Beyond both, there's just this being itself and it appearing as everything, you know. And it's like, yeah, of course it would have to dress itself up as everything. It would have to, you know, unconditional love. And I think I say this in the book somewhere. It's like, if you wanted to play a game, if you wanted to play a game of hide and seek, but also you wanted to make sure that you were eventually found, you would have, the only thing that you could possibly do is disguise yourself as everything.
Only everything.
Only everything.
Yeah.
It would have to be absolutely everything. So it's like, from one perspective, this appears to be incredibly well hidden. I mean, it does, doesn't it? Because it appears, people appear to miss it their whole lives.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's never been hidden at all. How could this be hidden? It's been showing itself, 100% revealing itself fully. So it's like incredibly well hidden from one perspective. And shockingly obvious from another perspective, and there are no perspectives.
Yeah. Yes, the perspectiveless perspective of, well, you know, the sage that wrote the Tao Te Ching said, I don't know what to call it, so I call it great. I don't know what to call it, so I call it love.
Yeah.
That chair just loves me to pieces.
it's just a giant embrace, you know. It's just you're just being held. It's just everything.
The dance of the stars and the dance of,
and it's like it's all there for you somehow. And again, we have to speak in paradoxes. Because there is no you, but there is that sense, it's all there for you. You know, it's like everything is yours, and of course nothing is yours. How could any of it be yours? Not possible. But at the same time, this is all yours. You know, the grass and the trees and the water to drink and food to eat and clothes to cover you and air to breathe.
No, I am no world.
Yeah.
So the I am and the world are certainly Advaita, not two.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so understanding that can be the booby prize, of course.
Yeah, this is always a complete, I mean, this is the last thing the seeker would ever want. I think people kid themselves that they want this.
Oh, absolutely.
Kid themselves they want this. People, you have no interest in this.
None.
Like, don't kid me. No one has any interest in this. How could you want this? How could anyone want this? Like, this is the last thing the mind wants. So it's like it kids. That's how it keeps the search going. It kids itself that it wants something called awakening, and that's how it fuels the search, keeps the search going. Yeah, that's what I want. I want a future awakening. I want a future liberation. That's what I want.
Yeah.
How could you want this?
No, when it's your own absence.
Exactly.
You want your own absence? Oh, tell me, yeah, really? Is that true? Do you really want your own absence?
It's like you're not even going to, people think they can get this.
Yeah.
So who's going to be there to get it? Who's going to be there to claim the prize?
Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, if 10 minutes from now this body is 6 feet under, nobody's going to know.
No.
At least not here.
But then it's like so we, you know, talking before about relationships, it's yeah. like, so just all that's left then, I mean, life becomes extraordinarily simple. It's just all that's left is just to meet whatever comes into this space, you know, just to meet whoever walks into this space. You know, as and to know that they're just a reflection of yourself, to know that there are no others, and yet to live in the world as if there were others, and to honor that totally, and to honor that these apparent others perhaps don't see this yet, you know, perhaps they don't see what's seen here, and they don't need to. You know, because you can love them anyway. It's like, can you love them anyway? That's what we were saying last time. It's like, it's like, are you only going to love them if they get this?
Mm.
You know, are you going to only love them if they're absent? And that would only be your story anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course you can't even know that. And that's where this kind of catty infighting begins, and the non-duality fights. You know, it's like I'm more absent than you, and I. I'm absent, you're not. Yeah, right, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean...
Yeah, give it a rest.
Come on.
Put a sock in it.
It's funny, there's a lot of absences out there that get very wound up, you know.
Yeah.
About you not being absent, it's like... My absence is bigger than yours, you know.
Yeah, or the other side of it being, you know, questioning. Well, I don't really think you're absent, but I am.
Yeah,
I'm the teacher. You can't tell me.
And again,
just another identity.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, and again, we've spoken about this before, haven't we? I mean, I completely understand that. That's the way I was, you know, years ago. You know,
well, then we come back to the innocence of it all.
Innocence of it. I know. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like I was watching somebody in the mall the other day, very old, hardly can move, and he's out there exercising, walking in the mall. The guy can barely move. Mm. And it's so damn beautiful. Mm. You know? And I was thinking, in his innocence, would he have ever decided to get that old and that decrepit that he could barely move? Mm. Of course not. Mm. Everything is happening in this complete innocence, isn't it?
Mm. And that's a lovely word actually for what this is. It's innocent because there's no control over it. You know, it's innocent. Each thought is innocent. Each sensation arises in that innocence.
You know, and I think that brings an essential humility without which there can't be any real clarity. Mm. And that's what resonates for me and always has about you is the essential humility that, you know, you don't consider yourself special or up on a pedestal. You don't consider yourself to be anything.
Well, I mean, surely if this is anything, it's the end of specialness.
Yes.
Like, leave your specialness, you know, at the door. You know, I mean, this is, your specialness will not survive here.
Right.
I mean, how the hell can you be special if you see you are equal to the fucking carpet?
Yeah. Even if the carpet is tattered and worn, it's still absolutely your equal.
Exactly, and that's total, like, crushing humility, you know. And again, it's not my humility. This is humility, you know, because it's like to be totally humbled by everything, to be humbled by the carpet. The carpet is infinitely greater than I am. I mean, it's like the flowers, the trees, the cars, the seagull on the beach. I mean, it's just
And the mightiest dream of time.
Yeah. And I'm, in the face of that, I'm nothing. In the face of that seagull or the old man exercising in the mall, he destroys me. I am nothing in the face of that. You know, he becomes everything.
Yes.
What appears in this, what is met in this, that is everything.
Yes.
You are always being destroyed by everything that you see, everything that you hear, everything that you taste. It's always destroying you or what you take yourself to be in that moment. If there's an openness to that, everything will destroy you. And that's the crucifixion, to be crucified by everything, to be crucified by every single thing that appears, every thought, every sensation, to be crucified by that old man exercising in the mall.
Yes.
That's love, to die into love. Not as a practice, you know, not as something that you're doing.
No, it happens, but though.
This is happening anyway.
Yeah.
This is the point. This is happening for every single human being in this world.
And that crucifixion is the resurrection.
Is the resurrection, exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't end with the crucifixion. It doesn't end with, I am no one.
Right.
There's the resurrection. I am someone again.
And I am everyone.
I'm everyone.
I am exactly. Everyone.
It's because I am no one that I can be everyone.
Yes.
It's like I have to be no one first. That has to be seen first somehow. You know, it's like once I'm no one, then I can see that I'm everyone. I'm nothing. I'm everything. You can't miss the everything.
And it's not an assertion the mind makes. It's direct immediacy of it, isn't it?
Exactly.
It just leaves you breathless. And then breath happens again.
Breath happens, yeah. Breathing happens or not, you know.
Yeah.
And I love what Byron Katie says. You know, she calls it the re-entry.
It's
the re-entry. You know, it doesn't just end with nothing and no one.
No, it's quite right.
Somehow it's
Zen woodcut.
Yeah, exactly. This has been said for thousands of years. This is nothing new. And I think that's part of the humility as well, is to see this is nothing new. You know, this is nothing new. I mean, of
Absolutely.
Course, it's brand new. At the same time, it's brand new.
Yeah.
But it's been said beautifully over the past, as long as there have been human beings on this earth, it's been said beautifully. So, and it's like, you know, it doesn't end with the nothing and no one. Somehow it goes back into the world, because how can it not? Because it is the world. It is the world. So how can it not go back into the world? Because it's in the world anyway. And then being in the world. It's actually nonsensical to talk about being.
Mm-hmm. Without the world. Being
without the world. Because without the world, there's no way of knowing being as being.
Say exactly.
There is no way of knowing being as being without the world. And this is
the self only can know itself in its reflections.
Of course, it's in relation to.
Yeah.
Be in relation to, because it's like, so the individual, you know, the individual looks out. Again, let's strip it down again. The individual appears to look out at the world, and the individual's world is always a reflection of the individual, and the individual's world is always the world of time and space. You know, and so within that world of time and space, the individual might discover these spiritual teachings, non-duality teachings, and hear about something called, I don't know, awakening, liberation, being or something. And they might, you know, begin to look for that. They might begin to look for something called being, liberation, oneness. And they start to look for it in the only place they can, which is in their world, which is in their own reflection. You know, you look for it within your own reflection, and everything you find within your world is simply your own reflection. So even if within your world you found something called being, say, it would only be your own reflection. And it's like these words that we're using now, you know, even these words, these words, the words being, the word liberation, I mean, all the words that we've used today, all the words that anyone has ever used, these are all words of the world. You know, these are all worldly words. These are words of the world of time and space. These words, you know, all these words, all the teachings, they are still completely within the dream world. Completely within the dream world. Anything you say immediately, it's in the dream world. It's a word that relates to the individual somehow.
Yeah.
So you can't pretend that you have a teaching or a word that somehow exists outside of the dream world of time and space. You can't. It's like what we're really trying. So I think I've said this before. What we're really trying to point to here, using words, it's not something that could be found, you know, within the world of time and space. Because what we're pointing to is, it's like the falling away of that world. It's the falling away of the individual and the individual's reflection. You know, it's the falling away of I and world. And anything, the moment we begin to talk about that falling away, we're straight back into the dream world. We're straight back into the world of time and space, into the world of words. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that we can say about that falling away. Nothing. So anything that is said must relate to the world.
Yeah.
So it's nonsensical to talk about being that is somehow, you know, this pure being that is somehow cut off from the world. It has to be in relation.
Being is the world.
Being is exactly. Because who would know being as being? Who would even be able to say being? Who would even be able to use that word? Who? it's like, man, that's a real trap in the spiritual search. I think it's this idea of this pure beingness that we can somehow, the individual. And it's always in terms of the individual. The individual wants to dive into that pure beingness and dwell there. You know, this pure beingness, you know, as opposed to the world.
Yeah.
Because the world is messy and smelly and illusory and impermanent. We don't like that. we want to dive into the ocean of pure being, which is untouched by time.
Right.
And that's a beautiful concept.
And only a concept.
Ultimately, you know, I mean, it's a gorgeous pointer. It's a beautiful pointer. But ultimately, you have to admit, it's still just a concept. And where is this pure being? You know, pure being. Show me pure beingness, and I'll show you someone with a story about
nice.
Pure beingness.
Yeah, very well said.
Show me pure beingness and I'll show you a world.
And the world is always showing itself with this love, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Love loving itself.
It's just all inclusive.
And that certainly is a good definition of love, is inclusivity.
Exactly. So the moment, so where this really leads is the moment you say anything, you must honor the opposite. The moment you say, I'm not here, you're straight back into the dream world. You've gone straight back into the dream world. You've gone straight back into the dream world. So, as I was saying last time, not true until it's balanced with the appearance of a world. Sorry, you know, I'm not here, wonderful pointer, but not true until it's balanced with the appearance of the individual in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be balanced, otherwise it's...
Because we both are and are not at the same
exactly,
time.
Exactly, yeah. So the person who really and truly believes that they have discovered their own absence... You know, the person who really and truly believes that
that's an oxymoron for you.
Okay. but then you see, then what happens? It becomes, if this isn't seen in absolute clarity, it just descends into a word game, into a language game And I see this all the time, this kind of one-upmanship. You know, we were talking before, what, my absence is better than your absence, or yeah. You know, I'm not here.
My everything's better than your everything.
Yeah.
Denial.
Denial. Yeah. Denial. Yeah. And denial is another word for suffering.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, let's call it by its real name. You know, it's suffering.
As is resistance.
Yeah. And again, this is all done in absolute innocence. Absolute innocence. Because I know, you know, years ago when, you know, I used to have the most awful arguments with well, it was mostly with my family, actually.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, it was, you know, like when my brother, you know, would tell me to do the washing up. Ask me very, very nicely, actually, if I would do the washing up, and I would go into this rage, you know, because he was assuming that there was a person here. And he was lost in his ego, you know, and you know, he wasn't clear, or you know, and just looking back, just the arrogance of it and the innocence of it, because I didn't know what I was doing. I was lost.
Yeah, you know, can't really have arrogance without innocence, because who would choose arrogance, would they?
Exactly.
And no one would choose arrogance because there's so much suffering in it.
Yeah, and it's like, if we knew what we were doing to ourselves, we just wouldn't do it. It's that simple.
Forgive me, Father, I know not what I do.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I know not what I do to myself.
And that I don't know, I mean, that's such a powerful thing, really. That's really where I wanted to start. That's the starting point for my book. You know, I don't know anything about non-duality anymore. You know, I used to know a lot. I used to have all the concepts. You know, I knew everything. I was the expert on non-duality.
No, I always knew more than you did after.
Okay, you know, I just don't know anymore. I'll tell you what I know. I know the feeling of the chair, you know, that I'm sitting on. I know that the air, you know, going in and out of my lungs. I know the mug of tea that I've got here, and the sound of birds singing outside. That's about all I know. And to be honest, I don't even know that. I mean, that can't even be known.
I would say that for me, it's I don't know, and yet it is known.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know. And yet knowledge appears.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't know what any of this is. I don't know what I am seeing. I don't know what I'm hearing. And yet knowledge comes. Knowledge comes and says, you're looking at a chair, you're looking at a cup. And actually that's part of this too. I used to think that this was all about getting rid of concepts. I used to think that this was about getting rid of knowledge, getting rid of the labels, getting rid of the names. But of course, who would get rid of all of that? Who would reject all of that? And what I came to see was actually that all of those names, all the concepts, all the knowledge, that was me. I didn't exist outside of the knowledge, the concepts. I didn't exist outside of that big bundle of concepts, memories. You know, I didn't exist outside of the chair. I didn't exist outside of the carpet. I didn't exist outside of the world.
All interdependent.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. And you know, and of course this still honors the ultimate message, ultimate in inverted commas, that there is no one, nothing, no world. You know, when there's no I, there's no world. No I, no world. But that's not you can't claim to live there. I mean, this is where it gets tricky, you know, but people who say, I'm not here. I don't live in a world. I am. It's like that's a person who's taken ownership. And the beauty of this, this cannot be owned. This cannot be owned. I used to know that I wasn't here.
Yeah.
I used to be very certain that there was no person here. And it's like, I can't even know that. you know, that, and that's like the real death, you know, that's the last, it's like, that's all I had left was my concept that I wasn't there. And I, so I clung onto that concept for dear life, you know.
Yeah, that's like the umbilical cord.
It's like, at least give me that.
Yeah.
You know, at least if you know, at least if you know that you're absent, at least you know something. It's safe. Apparently so.
But, yeah, apparently so. You know,
because it's not really a suffering. I mean, suffering.
Yeah, we fear dying, but when dying happens, there's this freedom, and it's, well, okay, who was ever afraid?
Mm.
Who could possibly be afraid of this infinite love?
Nothing and everything.
Nothing
and everything, and even that doesn't capture it. You know, it's like it's. Again, when we come right back to the beginning, it's just this.
Yeah, trying to put it in words, trying to capture it with words is like trying to capture space in a net, isn't it?
And we can kind of talk around it, and we can...
And that's really the beauty of it, too.
It's the beauty of it, yeah, exactly. That's beautiful. So just chatting, you know, sharing this with friends who are open to it, and and that's part of it, too, that the words are... a part of it, sharing the words. I don't know anymore.
There's a generosity in this not knowing.
Yeah, when you have nothing, you know, there's a lot to go around, as they say. Infinite amounts of it. When you don't know anything, there's infinite amounts of it to go around. It's because you're not afraid to lose it.
Yeah,
if you have something, there's only a certain amount of it. You kind of have to defend it. It needs to be defended. The moment you have something, you have to defend that something.
Because
you can lose that something. But when you don't have that something, then, you know, what's there to lose? And it's, then life is just, well, then life is, it's like life, it's, I think that the relief of it, a lot of people talk about, is that it's like finally, you know, it's like finally, life can just be itself. You know, it's like, finally, this can just be this again. And the cosmic joke is that this has always been this.
Yeah.
It never really needed our permission to be itself. It's always been being itself.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Just seen, perhaps, you know, seen for what it is. I don't know.
Mm.
Seeing this just... for what it is, you know, without the illusions, without the mythology,
without the cantankerous bullshit.
Bullshit.
Yes, I appreciate the absence of bullshit.
Absence. A bullshit. This is a bullshit-free zone, Shirley.
An unconditional absence.
And what has arisen in this over here is that Amy has just
Hello, Amy.
Hello, Amy.
He's
just inserted season 2 of 6 Feet Under into our DVD player, so I think
perfect,
that's the
perfect timing. Everything happens right on time, doesn't it?
6 Feet Under appears exactly when it needs to.
Well, I'm happy that the universe wanted us to connect at this time.
Oh, me too, Charlie. It's really, yeah, it's just lovely talking to you. And
yeah, same here. Great pleasure.
Lots of love.
And to you, and give that Amy a hug for me.
I will do. I'll give her a big hug.
Yeah, well, I'm a big guy, so make it a big hug. All right.
A Charlie strength hug.
Enjoy the evening.
Will do. You too, Charlie. Lots of love.
And to you. Bye now.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked along narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one dared disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell and echoed in the wells of silence. The people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made, and the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls, whispering